final session of Q&A. And what number of challenging questions that you all left for the last. Okay, so I'll try to, again, explain them as I know how. Okay, yes, we'll jump straight in. Question 21. If we do an activity that may stumble others but is not sinful, and examples given were skateboarding and going to the cinemas, if we just don't tell people about it, would that be okay, since we are not stumbling others if they do not know about it? Right. What do you all think? Sorry? Depends on when you do those things. Well, okay, strictly speaking, I mean, if you talk about the teachings concerning stumbling in the Bible, the answer is, well, yes, you don't have to live your life governed by other people. Okay? You know, there's example of food offered to idols. You can read, you know, the whole passage in 1 Corinthians 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Is it? 8, 9, 10, I think. He spent quite a lot of time, Paul spent quite a lot of time talking about stumbling and the principles of it and all that, right? And so, yes, it's true that we don't want to stumble others with our conduct. But at the same time, he says, well, I mean, the food inherently is not sinful, right? You know, it's just food, okay? And if you don't know about it, doesn't mean there's anything wrong about eating it. If you go to the marketplace, you see the food sold in shambles, you ask no question for conscience sake. But if you are there with a weaker brethren and they know about it, for example, you're invited to eat at someone's house and there is this food offered, and the host tell you that this is food that's been offered to idols. So you say, eat not for conscience sake, and the purpose is that we do not stumble some of the weaker brethren around us. And this will refer to perhaps newly converted Jews, because to them, they were still very much under the dietary laws. And well, if you suddenly do these things and eat food that is not, you know, to them may seem a bit ungodly to eat, then he says, well, you don't do that. But of course, it doesn't mean that you are not allowed to eat at all. Okay? So, but having said that, this does not then give us license to do what we want. Be very careful. What actually constitutes an activity that stumbles others? For Paul, it was quite clear-cut, right? Those were the situations they faced at that point of time, but now we don't face the same thing anymore. A lot of times, people want to use this as a license or an excuse to do things that they want to do, but then to do it in secret so that nobody knows. Not so much that they are fearful or concerned about stumbling others. It's really that, well, I don't want to be judged, right? A lot of times, that's more the issue, isn't it? And so, well, you cite things like skateboarding or going to the cinemas. Now, sometimes we ask, are these things really inherently not sinful? Yes, it is just a sport, true. Yes, it is just, you know, going to see a show. But, well, we know the contents of many of the shows nowadays. We also know the sort of association or connotations that sometimes some of these activities do bring about. I mean, I'm not saying skateboarding is wrong. I think, well, if that's your sport, sure, by all means, go ahead. Okay, but we must be careful about what we think is not sinful. Okay, that's one thing I want to highlight. A lot of times you say, it's nothing wrong with it. Really? Sometimes, well, it may not be wrong in itself, but you yourself, you may be caught up in these activities and you willfully do it despite being told not to. Okay, and then the other question, of course, is that this idea of stumbling, what does it really mean? Okay, this idea of stumbling, what does it really mean? Sometimes we kind of, you say, use this word quite loosely. To say that, oh, this person, some people like to use it quite, I'm stumbled by this, I'm stumbled by that. Or maybe you will cause that to stumble. And it really isn't really the case. What does stumbling really mean? It means a person is, his faith gets shaken, okay? In whatever way, because of your action, because of your thing, whatever you're doing. And the very reason why you feel a need to hide it, that's a question mark in itself. Okay? That's what I would say. So, really, the situation is not so simple. And again, there's no easy answer to these sort of things. Because you quoted two examples, but there are a whole range of activities which, in certain instances, I think it's completely fine, But there are other instances in which you really shouldn't do it, even if nobody sees. Okay? So I would put this down really under your own Christian discernment. And it boils down back to the same idea of what are you doing these things for? Okay? Because that is really the key that we need to ask ourselves. Not so much if it is, does a person know or not and all that, but we are ultimately accountable only to God. Okay? So what we'll say is that, well, what is the purpose in doing these things that you want to do? Recreation, enjoyment. But are these things that you can give up? Are you willing to give up for a blameless testimony? Because, you know, the way it is phrased seems to be that, well, I'm afraid that, and I want to do it, but I'm afraid someone might see it, right? But what's to say that, you know, even if you do it so-called in secret, nobody will know, right? I mean, you go to a cinema, you think that I didn't tell anyone. What if someone sees you at the cinemas, right? And how are we going to explain that? And if you think that by doing so, this will stumble others, are we willing to then just completely do away with these things and say, well, you know, it's not vital in my life. And if it be that I can help a brethren through these things which I do, well, then so be it. Okay? So please, you know, what I'll say is you have to ask the right questions. It's good that we have a concern that we don't want to stumble others, but at the same time, we have to have a concern not just for that, but also that our testimony is really blameless in all aspects and we are always doing the right thing. Okay? I don't know if this quite answers the question. I know I've been going kind of round and round. But these are the few principles that I will share. Okay? Because, you know, doing something which you think that, you know, may cause someone to stumble, but just keep doing it in secret, somehow doesn't quite feel right to me. Right, that's what I'll say. Somehow doesn't quite feel right. The circumstances that Paul had in 1 Corinthians, also in Romans chapter 13 and 14, right? Also concerning stumbling. You know, he was very, very careful to say that I owe no man anything but to love him. And what is my love for him? It is living my life for his sake. Okay? So we should really always have a concern for brethren far more than our own enjoyment. If so be that you feel that something you do really does or has a potential to cause someone to stumble, then well, you should then be willing to just say, I will just completely do away with it. Okay? Rather than secretly doing it, and then after that, you know, having a chance of maybe I'll get caught. And sometimes the repercussions of that are even worse. Because you portray an image, oh, no, no, I don't do these things, but you're actually doing it on the sly. Right? I think that's even worse. Okay, so that's verse question 21. Any follow-up questions to this? No. Moving on. How do we explain battles in the Bible where killings, murders occurred? How do we refute others if they argue this to be the basis of their acceptance of killings and murders in the current day? I don't quite think people actually say that. That, oh, just because they killed in the Old Testament, therefore I can kill today. If that is your argument, I think there's something seriously wrong with not just your understanding of the Old Testament, but your understanding of God and the Bible and everything else. More often than not, the other sort of argument that you hear is that the Bible is such a gruesome book, right? It's inconsistent. Or they will go so far as to say, God is a cruel God, I don't want to believe because of how God treated people in the Old Testament. I think that is more, you can say, a concern. Now, the explanation to this is that, well, in the Old Testament, the situation was very different. They were not a church, they were a nation. And so the rules for nations are different, as you know. Right? As a nation, they have the right to defend themselves. As a nation, they were to conquer the land which God told them to conquer. And of course, God never errs. And so when God gave them these commandments to go into Canaan, to destroy them, kill them, all that, a lot of times these were judgments. God says the sins of the Canaanites are full, the sins of whoever are full, and therefore you are my instrument, my tool to go and bring judgment upon them. And that was God's right. Okay? It was not that they were freely to just go about and kill anyone they liked. That was not the case. It was only under God's commandment. And as God's people, they had that right. Okay? And so they were instructed by God. Sometimes it was for their survival as a nation. Sometimes it was to show God's power and might and things like that. But God always had a good reason for doing and commanding what they did. Now for us, it's very different. We're a church. We're no longer a nation. We don't have national laws, we don't have lands and boundaries to defend. Okay? So there is really no basis upon which we as a church or as Christians in this present age should ever take up arms to kill. Having said that, it is not always wrong to kill. Do you realize that? Because the nations around us still have that sort of right, the death penalty. I know it's not practiced here anymore, but Singapore still does that. Some countries still do that. And I believe that is a biblical practice, right? Because Israel as a nation was given the right to have instituted this sort of death penalty for offenders. And so, you know, we have that in our land as well, okay, to punish for certain crimes that are serious enough to warrant a death penalty. So, yes, it is not a basis for murder, but killing is not always wrong. Likewise, in times of warfare, okay, we were taught to bear arms. And if, although it is, I believe, highly unlikely, but if Singapore does go to war, and if I am called back, as much as I don't want to, but I will have to load my rifle, and if the enemy stands before me, it will be my obligation or duty, rather, to kill. Okay? And so, does that go against my belief in the Lord, in the Bible? I don't think so. Okay? Because as a nation, there is such an authority, there is such a jurisdiction given to them. Okay? I hope this answers the question. Anyone disagrees? No. Okay. 23. Question 23. Where was Lazarus, the brother of Mary and Martha, in the 4 days he was dead? Absent with the body, present with the Lord. He was in heaven. Okay? Simple as that. He came down. I believe that was not a very happy thing for him to have to go through. Really. I mean, he was in heaven. He was a believer. He was in heaven. And he was called back from the dead. And then he had to live through the life again and then die again and then go to heaven. Okay, but of course, this was done as a demonstration of the power of God. Before that, he told them, I am the resurrection and the life. Right? He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. Believest thou this? Okay? So I believe, well, he was in heaven. Okay, next question. Any follow-up questions? No. Okay, next one. When would hell have been created, or did it always exist? There is no, you can say, particular verse that says hell was created on this particular day. I believe it was created on day one. Why? Because in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and I believe within that, hell was also created. Okay, but again, that's not something we want to be dogmatic about. Definitely, it was created within the first 6 days of creation, because everything that was made was created then. Okay, including angels. Angels were also created sometime in the first 6 days of creation. Again, don't know when, perhaps on the first day. Okay? That's as much as we can say about this. Next one, question 25. Your non-Christian friend asks you for relationship advice. For example, whether going into relationship is a good idea. And this is, well, with regards to boy-girl relationships, I believe. They know your beliefs as a Christian and you've witnessed to them before. How will you respond? Well, it's an opportunity to share the gospel again. I think it is. Because, I mean, when you ask you for your advice will be what? Based on biblical principles, isn't it? I mean, share your perspective with regards to relationships, and your perspective comes from God. Meaning to say that, well, marriage is for life. Marriage is, you know, a demonstration of Christ and His love. Perhaps you can bring that in. Or to tell them that, you know, how we choose a life partner is really with biblical criteria, right? They love the Lord, you know, they are really faithful people who can lead me in the faith, or, you know, that, you know, we can encourage one another in the faith, and things like that. Of course, I mean, we just say as it is, right? You can tell them about seeking God's will, that is the way that we, you know, find out whether it's a good match or not. Because to them, their criteria will be completely different, isn't it? Common interest, perhaps. She makes me laugh. She's pretty. I love her smile. I love her eyes, her long hair, whatever. I mean, these things you would tell them that, you know, this really doesn't matter. And so you get to, it's an opportunity for you to share your biblical perspectives with them. And, hopefully through this, they can also come to realize, you know, why we do what we do. Okay? Moving on to the next question. Question 26. Now, what is the point where you stand up for what you legally deserve, such as compensation or fair treatment, or let people tread over you about it? Well, it's quite hard to say, really, because a lot of times it's a case-by-case scenario. It really depends on the circumstances of what's going on here. But I will say that the principle behind your decision, again, it is for Christ. Okay? Yeah, Christ told us to turn the other cheek, go the extra mile, give him the other cloak, that sort of things, right? All these things said in the Sermon of the Mount. But what is the purpose behind all these things? It is for your Christian testimony, isn't it? It's so that people will see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. So I would say, as far as it is, we want our testimony to be known. And if so be that we are allowed, or we allow people to so-called take advantage of us, and through this we have an opportunity to witness, or they will see your patience and your long-suffering, your meekness, I think that's a good thing. But of course, it doesn't mean that we just become doormats for everyone, right? If there are situations where it's really within your right, and you know, there's nothing about your against your testimony in doing so, right? For example, you signed a contract with a company, and they say they're going to pay you, but they didn't pay you. You don't just say, "Oh, give them another mile, lah. I'll work another month and then let them." I mean, yeah, at the times that you have to exercise your rights, you write that a very gentle, nice letter to the HR department or to your boss, explaining the situation and say, fairly, based on fair agreement and the trade and all that, on the contract and all that, well, please, you know, could I have my salary? The wrong thing to do, of course, then is to barge in the office, throw the contract before him, and then, you know, with a very bad attitude, demanding tone, and say, "Hey, you know, I'm going to sue you, I'm going to bring you to whatever complaint, to whatever authority." That is a bad testimony. Okay, so the basis of it is really what? Your purpose in life. It all boils down to that, isn't it? I'm here to maintain and bear a good testimony for Christ. If so be that people are nasty and mean, willfully against me, they make fun of me and all these things, well, I just take it, lah. Okay, take it. And so, well, it's really a case-by-case sort of thing. Maybe one example we can share is with regards to the FEBC lawsuit that's been going on. I'm sure you have heard some of it. And you see, the first so-called lawsuit that we had to go through, what was at stake was not self or pride or personal rights. It was really the name of God at stake, right? Because they were, they were accusing us of having a wrong doctrine, and for that basis, they wanted us out. So it's not so much that we wanted the land so much and we had to go to the courts and fight all the way up. It was really, to defend the name of God, to defend the word of God, and for that reason, yes, we went to the courts. Okay, but that was fought and won. And recently, another lawsuit was initiated by them. This time, it was just simply for money's sake. They sent a lawyer's letter to say that you have been, tenant, so-called, for the past, 40 over years. Okay, because they said, okay, since now the court has decreed that you are a separate body, it's time for you to pay up. Because all this while, you've been staying here rent-free, you've not been paying for your utilities. And so they sued for a sum of about $250,000, saying that, well, this is just me making a claim for all the utilities that I've been using for the past many years. Despite the fact, of course, that FEBC had already made offers to pay for these things, but they refused it in the past because they felt that that would bolster their case in the previous lawsuit. Okay? Because if we pay it, then it would appear that there is this sort of relationship going on, that we are two separate bodies. They wanted to make a case for the fact that, no, they are our ministry, and we've always been supporting them. So now that they said, oh, a judge has decreed that we are separate ministries, separate bodies, entities, oh, you pay up. So in response to this, we were told, board of directors were told by FEBC that you have a very strong case because there is no reason for you to pay up, in light of everything that's been going on in the past, and especially so that you have offered to pay and they refused it, right? So the board of directors took that into consideration, but they reviewed the whole thing, the whole matter, and they realized, well, what is the point of fighting this particular case? What is at stake here? It's just money, right? It's just money because the courts have already decreed and ruled that, it is not a doctrinal deviation from the Westminster Confession of Faith, that the belief in the Bible's preservation is really consistent with the stand from the very beginning and so on and so forth. That was settled. Now, this is just about money. It's about pride, really. It's just about pride. And so the decision from the board of directors was, well, I mean, just pay. Or we'll just settle. However much you want, we'll just pay it. And, I mean, this is the example of turning the other cheek for testimony's sake. Okay? But what I've heard recently is that they have kind of made a revision to their claim and they want some more money. They increased the amount. That was what I was told recently. Okay, I don't know the details of this and what is the board of directors' decision after this, but well, we'll wait and see. Okay, but again, comes back to the same principle. If it is the name of God at stake, yeah, we fight. We're not fighting for our own glory, but we're fighting for Him. If it is just self, right, it is, well, we can just take a step back and say, well, I mean, it's just my name, it's just my pride, it doesn't matter. Okay? Right, verse... Question 27. When we get our glorified bodies, do we actually see God the Father? Now, I said that just now. No. Right, God is a spirit, and I believe He'll always be a spirit. We can see God the Son. That's it. Okay, we'll see the Lamb, but not God. Perhaps we'll see the light of God's glory. Okay, that may be the only visible thing that we can see of Him. But God is a spirit, and that's what we are told multiple times. And that's for that reason we don't have idols. That's why God is so strong against idols. Because, well, I have no corporeal form. I have no physical form that you can worship. Question 28. Is it a sin to consume alcohol if we are not drinking to get drunk? Okay, now this is quite a big issue. It's a big, you can say, debate that is going on. The Bible Presbyterian Church, if you don't know, we take a position of total abstinence. What this means is that we consume no alcoholic beverage at all. I would say yes. When you consider alcoholism or alcohol drinking in the light of our current present day context, I would say yes, it is a sin to consume alcohol for a variety of reasons. Okay? You look at the Old Testament perspective, you look at the whole biblical perspective towards alcoholism, drinking, it is almost invariably negative. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging. If anyone is deceived thereby, he is not wise, right? Proverbs 20 very clearly tells us these things. In numerous passages throughout the book of Proverbs, you see that as well. Okay, strong biblical injunctions given against the consumption of even just, well, drink, alcohol. Having said that, a lot of people will then protest and say, hey, didn't Jesus turn water into wine? Didn't Paul tell Timothy to drink a little for your stomach's sake? Right. One thing you have to realize is the nature of alcohol in the Bible is very, very different from what we have today. Okay. For one, the percentages of alcoholic content was greatly, very, very different. Right. Wine in the Bible, you know, at most through their ancient, what's the word for it? Fermentation process, right? Could only get alcoholism to perhaps a few percent, that's about it, right? But wine today is what, 14 point something percent? Vodka, strong drink, spirits, rum, whiskey, all these go all the way up, 50%, if I'm not wrong, and some of them may go even higher. And these are extremely strong drink, artificially created by man with their processes for the specific purpose of getting man inebriated, right? Getting him to lose control. Instead, we also see continually instructions about us to be sober, sober-minded, temperance, always to be in control of yourself. Be not drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. Okay? So what we realize is that, you know, drinking, even social drinking at the lightest level, would also cause us to lose some of our senses and some of our control and cause us to do silly things. Now, in response to the question about didn't Jesus turn water into wine, specifically in that instance, my answer is that Jesus did not. I do not believe Jesus created alcoholic wine. Wine, in that word in the Bible, also can refer just to grape juice, the fruit of the vine, right? The result of wine. And if you examine the context of that passage very clearly, you would see that they were very surprised when Jesus brought forth this wine. It was through the feast that had been going on for a few days, and they ran out of whatever they had at that point of time. And then what he did was to fill water pots with water and then bring forth this new wine. And he was so surprised that, well, this is good wine. This is wine that you should have brought forth at the very beginning. And what is the nature of such wine? It was so surprising because it was probably a period of time after the harvest, and by then any grape juice that they have had would have been undergone the fermentation process. Okay? And that was what they were drinking. But Jesus brought forth wine that was freshly made. And that is, well, fresh grape juice. And it's something that could not be found during that season at that time. And they were extremely surprised. And that is seen as the good wine, the best, the very best grade. Okay? Because nobody will be able to preserve the grape juice during for a long period of time. Jesus was able to do that, and that was the nature of the miracle that he performed. Furthermore, I would ask this question. Would Jesus create something, wine in that sense, that will cause a person to get drunk? I don't believe so, right? Jesus will create something that is perfect, not something that's undergone fermentation. Jesus will create something that would, well, it's a pure drink that he would drink, and that he would allow the guests around him to drink as well. Okay? The explanation then about Timothy telling Paul would be that, you see, in those days, drinking water was scarce, right? It's not the same sort of fresh, clean water that we get from the taps today. And a lot of times, they would drink impure water, and one of the solutions to that is pour a little bit of alcohol, for a very diluted drink, right? To kind of sterilize the water somewhat, to make it a little bit more healthy to drink. And so, yes, did they drink alcohol in those days? Yeah, in tiny amounts, but really not as a beverage, you know, to get drunk and enjoyment, but really to help them to sterilize their water so that they would not get sick. And instead, what you would see then from this account between Paul and Timothy, perhaps Timothy was being so strict with himself, very careful that he did not want a hint of wine to lose control of himself. And so he did not drink wine, and Paul had to tell him, well, for your health's sake, for your stomach's sake, it's okay to pour a little bit into your water to, you know, perhaps, purify it somewhat, so it's good for your health. Okay, so it was for health reasons that Paul gave this advice to Timothy. And not, in fact, otherwise, you look through the Bible, there is just continual injunctions against drinking. And another thing that I would say is, in light of today's context, today, okay, I would say specifically now, not talking about Bible times anymore, but drinking is always associated with what? With vice, isn't it? Associated together with gambling, going out, clubbing, pubbing, getting smashed on the weekends and things like that, right? That is the connotation that it has, and even the government understands this. I believe there's a law here, right, that says you can't carry drink in public, outside, something like that. And then they carry paper bags to hide the fact that they're holding bottles of wine, and then they pour it into Coke bottles to seem that they're not drinking alcohol. I think that's something they do here, right? I used to see that all the time in Perth. They carry paper bags, you know what they're doing, right? So, I mean, even the government recognizes this, and there are sanctions and laws in place. And what more for Christians, right? We want to have a blameless testimony. We want to really stand apart from the world. And if we know that this is the world's drink, then we should abstain, right? We should stand apart from all these things. Okay, so for this, these various reasons, I would say, yes, we must take a stand as Christians for total abstinence. Now, the follow-up question is this. What about foods that have alcohol in them? Chocolates with liquor, and I think fruitcake, and, you know, some sherry truffle, and what other fruits? I mean, some foods have it, right? I would say generally the amounts given in there is really, really nothing compared to drink. Okay. So they use it, and sometimes, a lot of times, it's evaporated in the cooking, right? You bake the tiramisu, the alcohol is gone. So I think, I mean, to these things, we don't want to be so strict or, you know, pedantic about it, right? How many percent? It's like, you know, I think it would take really quite a lot of chocolates to get you slightly tipsy. Yeah. I would draw the line at testimony sake then, okay? Testimony sake. That, well, yes, I understand. They have light beers and things like that. It's about, 5%, right? Lemon lime bitters, which I understand is that little shot of bitters with, you know, fizzy lemonade, something like that. Yeah. I've drunk lemon lime bitters before. I think it's quite nice. Is it alcoholic? So I'll say testimony and association is very important, right? I mean, nobody's going to call you a drunkard for, you know, eating fruitcake, right? It's just part of the ingredients. But, well, you know, holding a bottle of drink, that can lead to a lot of questionings, right? So, yeah, I would say that which is about association and testimony, okay? And also the perspective that the Bible has against drinking, getting drunk. And of course, it's very hard to draw the line, right? Social drinking. Once you allow that, where are you going to stop? One, two, three drinks? Oh, I'm very strong. I won't be affected. I can drink five drinks. And so, well, how are you going to draw the line? The pride of men will always say, no, I'm not drunk. And they will just keep going on. Okay? So, yes, that's the explanation that I will give concerning drinking. Any questions? Follow on to that. I've drunk lemon lime bitters. Is it really alcoholic? But it costs the same as every other drink, so I assume that. it's again just like flavoring, right? Because it doesn't taste alcoholic. So, sorry. Okay, can. Next. 29. Right, we'll go to the next question. Is your prayer valid if you pray, but you are unaware that the outcome of what you prayed for has already happened? Well, there are examples of these things in the Bible itself, right? Remember yesterday we talked about the prayer meeting they had for Paul, for Peter, and they were still praying when Peter had already been released. Now, we have to again question, what is the purpose of prayer? It is not so that we can move the hand of God to conform to our desires or to say that, well, a prayer is valid if it happens, if it doesn't happen, and things like that, right? Prayer is really about your relationship with God. And He understands. I mean, we are unaware of what's going on. Perhaps you prayed for something that has already happened or is no longer valid. Well, it's still a valid prayer in the sense where you have spent time in communion with God. Okay, just because the request is not met, or it is met, and things like that, right? It doesn't change the nature of your prayer. And furthermore, of course, God understands, right? He knows exactly why you're praying and what you prayed for, and well, He has already answered even before we began the prayer. I realize that in many instances as well, God set in motion the plans that will come as an answer to prayers even before the prayers were made. Okay? You see that in many of the Old Testament times when God delivered them from great danger, a lot of times they prayed, but actually, you know, plans had already been set in motion, things were already happening before they knew it. But again, well, it's not about the outcome, it's about the relationship that you have with God through the prayer. Okay? Is there a follow-up question? No. Final one, question 30. It's really quite an interesting one. How should we treat newly converted transsexuals who are aware and repentant of their wrongdoings? So I believe these are people who have already changed sex, right? Because the follow-up question says that, of course, treating them like people is a given, but it might get complicated when we go into the details of things like which gender pronoun to use, whether said person should undergo a reversal change operation, I don't know if this is even possible, or whether marriage is out of the question. So I believe it is of a person who has already changed his gender, right? Because, I mean, if he's just cross-dressing, well, change back, lah. I mean, stop wearing those clothes, okay? But someone who has already undergone the physical change, right, where he was a man, but he no longer has man parts, and he has lady parts now. So how do we treat them? That's what you're asking, right? It's tough, okay? I would say that the person must recognize that sin has its consequences. Okay? Sin always has its consequences. He may have repented, and he is now, or she is now a Christian. Okay? Okay, let's just take it as an example of a guy who has become a girl. She must realize that sin has consequences. And so there will be, you cannot be expected to be treated like a normal, regular person anymore. Okay, having said that, how do we regard him or her? I think for, you know, to prevent confusion, because she has every appearance of a lady, she should be treated as a lady, right? She goes to the ladies' toilet, you know, she has a feminine, I mean, she's completely female, right? After having gone this said operation. If it is possible, I think I would advise reversal, okay? Because that's, I mean, how God created him. But, you know, when you begin to ask about things like marriage, being asked about, expect so-called fair treatment, I think the person really has to understand that you have really committed a sin and it has grave, grave consequences. I'm not so sure about this marriage question, okay? If you are able to convert back, that means you are reversed back to your original one, and then you know, you have a relationship with a female, I think that is fine. But the other way around, I don't think I would say yes to that, okay? That means you were a man, you are now a lady, and you want to marry a guy? I would say I don't think that works, okay? Because that would be an abomination to God, because you were created one way, and you changed yourself, and you now want to have a relationship with one of your own gender. I don't think that should be allowed. Okay? So, but I mean, again, this is a very specific case, and, you know, when we encounter these things, I think that's time that we really examine exactly the nature of this particular case, and we'll react accordingly. All right. I don't know if out of your discussion, what do you all come up with? Something similar? Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, but I think, I mean, what I understand is sometimes they really go through like hormonal treatments and, I mean, stuff. There's real physical. Sorry? Yeah. So again, yeah, I understand it's an extremely tricky situation, and I mean, this is what I can think of. I guess, you know, when it really happens, I think that's when the church really has to pray and to seek the Lord's guidance for this, right? On how to really treat the person well, such that they are not discouraged, they are encouraged, but at the same time, we show that we do not condone the sin that has taken place. Okay? So I hope that helps. Any other questions? Yeah. Yeah. It was said that they heard footsteps and things like that, right? But there was never any mention of the fact that they saw him. Spoke, yeah. So what I believe is that it was like how many other people spoke to God in the past. There's a voice, perhaps, and they, you know, I mean, to them, that's all they knew. They were made, and then there was a voice, okay? So they interacted with God in that, you can say, innocent manner. Yeah, correct. But, I mean, God still does not have a visible image, right? There's no visage of God, but they would perhaps know somehow, through some means, the presence of God, okay? That God was there in their midst. And of course, God was everywhere, but God would manifest himself in a certain way to make known his presence to them, okay? But I would say no, that you can't see God, okay? Any other questions? It's all good. Okay, thank you all for your time. All interesting questions made me think as well. I hope that what I've shared with you will be helpful to you as well. Okay.